Yeah, definitely. Jeremy, I think this is your life story about you working for the state of Maryland.
Yeah, it's not quite dystopian yet. Give us time.
You just need to move to Ohio.
My brother is in Cincinnati area, so he's been there. He can tell me all about it.
There's nothing good in Ohio. Nothing.
Hello, and welcome to Movie
Smash!
Hello and welcome to Movie Smash, a show where we dive headfirst into comic book movies outside the MCU. If you're new to the show, thanks for joining us. If you've been here before, you know the drill. Each episode, we're going to smash a movie whose source material is from a graphic novel or a comic. Is it worth revisiting? Should it be forgotten? Let's find out. This is Movie Smash. I'm one of your hosts, Chris Roberts. I'm the founder of All Panel Creations. With me today, I have a man who makes the best eggy in a blanket I know of, Jeremy Parmentier.
Hey, this is Jeremy Parmentier, also the Retrovaniacs podcast. And Chris, I don't keep track of our calendar, but if this isn't being posted on the 5th of November, we've made a horrible decision.
Also, let me say, I swear they are not Fergal in a Guy Fawkes mask. Lori Calcaterra.
Hi, everybody. I'm Lori Calcaterra, writer, creator of Path of the Pale Rider and podcaster, hostess of the Tuesday Morning Brew. Sadly, I am not Fergal Amayo. However, I'm a little bit cuter. Too bad you can't see me. Too bad.
And also with us for our guest this evening, we have Michael Box from Echo Eternia Productions. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I am Mike, co-founder of Echo Eterna. We're an indie film studio in the Dayton, Cincinnati area in Ohio. I'm a screenwriter, filmmaker, musician, and some call me a Trivia Night MVP. Currently in pre-production for our upcoming film, Speakeasy. It's a film about a group of punk musicians struggling under an oppressive authoritarian system where self-expression has been regulated and criminalized.
Yeah, definitely. Jeremy, I think this is your life story about you working for the state of Maryland.
Yeah, it's not quite dystopian yet. Give us time.
You just need to move to Ohio.
Yeah. My brother is in Cincinnati area, so he's been there. He can tell me all about it.
There's nothing good in Ohio. Nothing.
No, just Echo Eternal Productions.
So our movie tonight is 2005's V for Vendetta, starring Hugo Weaving, Natalie Portman, Rupert James, Stephen Ray, and Stephen Fry, directed by James McTeague.
I wish I wasn't afraid all the time, but I am.
People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people.
Gentlemen, I want this terrorist found, and I want him to understand what terror really means.
We're working on several leads.
Her parents were detained when she was 12.
It was like those black bags erased them from the face of the earth.
You have one chance. You must tell us the whereabouts of Codename V.
So, guys, before we jump in this, Mike, you select this movie off 100 or so movies. Actually, it's like 400 or 500 movies. Why did you pick this one?
Well, you know, after giving the rundown of our film that we're working on, it's pretty obvious that dystopian, anti-authoritarian genre is definitely up my alley. I watched this in the theater when it first released, and it's always had a pretty big impact on me as far as that goes. And I'm a huge graphic novel nerd, so it's just great that it has, you know, one of the best, most respected graphic novel publications out there. So yeah, let's dive into it.
Oh, this will be a lot of fun. I'm like, it sounds like you were familiar with the comic, but the other two, were you guys familiar with the comic before seeing this movie?
No.
I knew about it, and it's one of those, like, on the list of things that every time I walk into the comic store, I'm like, I should get a graphic novel. And it's always on the list of, like, I'll get it this time. And I'm like, no, there's something else I want that is newer or whatever. So I've never actually read it, although, you know, I feel like I know most of it anyway, because everybody kind of has talked about this to some level. A lot of my friends really like this story. I told them we were doing it. They're like, oh, you've never seen this before? I was like, no, none of them have ever seen it. I never read it. So it's finally time. Yeah, I know.
Wow. It made a big splash when it came out. Like, it was huge.
Yeah,
right?
And
it was
strangely, it's very prescient today. So it's just,
isn't it weird?
It's like it never goes away. It's like listening to Rage Against the Machine from 1992 and going, wow, did they write this yesterday? I did read this during my first year in college. I reread it recently, so I'm pretty familiar with the graphic novel as well.
Yeah, I went to go get ready for the show today to take a look at my copy of it. I didn't realize I have 3 copies of this book. So if Jeremy,
you
ever need to borrow it. Yeah, I don't know where they came from.
Chris, I'll pay for one. I want one.
Like, so that and Watchmen. I don't know how you just, the copies like multiply on my shelf. I don't know why.
Yeah, I have that one too. But it's like, it's one of those when you find out that it's a graphic, like you get introduced to it because it's a movie and you find out it's a graphic novel, it immediately gets added to the list of, I need to have this.
if you feed it after midnight or it gets wet, they'll reproduce.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
That explains quite a bit. It's like Atomic Blonde. Like, it's one of those movies you go into and you're like, I don't know, this was a comic? And all of a sudden you realize it's a comic.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, exactly. Add to the list.
Right.
Add to cart.
So did I hear you right, Lori and Jeremy? This is your first time seeing this movie?
No, I've seen it probably 4 or 5 times. I've seen it a lot. It's a great movie. Mm-hmm. I just didn't realize it was a graphic novel.
Every one of these episodes, you're like, Jeremy, have you not seen this? And apparently I've seen one movie ever. I've seen Goonies and that's it. So it's nice to catch up with all the things I haven't seen.
Remaining 30 or 40 years since Goonies, yeah.
And since Fergal's not with us, say, Lori, would you like to be our comic historian of the night?
Sure, if you guys don't mind me reading from Wikipedia. I'm very good at that. All right, some history on this graphic novel. So V for Vendetta is a British graphic novel written by Alan Moore and illustrated by David Lloyd with additional art by Tony Ware. I think that's how you say it. It's like werewolf, were.
Yeah, don't ask me.
Okay, so initially published in 1982 and 1985 in black and white as an ongoing serial in a British anthology named Warrior. Its serialization was completed in 1988 and 89 in a 10-issue color limited series published by DC Comics in the United States. Subsequent collected editions were typically published under DC's specialized imprint Vertigo until the imprint went under in 2018. So since then, it's been transferred to DC Black Label. The story depicts a dystopian and post-apocalyptic near-future history version of the United Kingdom, which is interesting, preceded by a nuclear war in the 80s that devastated most of the rest of the world. And that, here's where it gets really technical. The Nordic supremacist, neo-fascist, outwardly Christo-fascist, and homophobic fictional Norse Fire political party has exterminated its opponents in concentration camps and now rules the country as a police state. What weirds me out is all these dystopian things that were written from the 1980s seem much more relevant now in 2025.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of times films are our future.
It's weird. In fact, I was invited to go speak at a San Diego Comic-Con on a panel because I also write dystopian fiction, right? And the panel was called Writing Dystopian Fiction in an Ever-Increasing Dystopian Reality. So it's just, it's bizarre now, you know what I mean? When you read this stuff and then you compare it to current events, it's like, at what point at the library do we move dystopian fiction to current events? I don't know.
Before you jump in and start spoiling this movie, let me get the spoiler warning for everybody. So if this is your first time joining us, just a heads up, we're going to be discussing certain elements of this movie that would be considered spoilers of this movie called Agent Smith Goes to London. So consider yourself warned.
Is that enough of a recap for you?
Oh, I think it was great. So Mike, why don't you tell us what actually happens in this movie sort of beyond what Lori just told us? Because you let it little.
Well, the plot synopsis from IMDb is pretty succinct, so I'm just going to let us share that. In a future British dystopian society, a shadowy freedom fighter known only by the alias of V plots to overthrow the tyrannical government with the help of a young woman. Obviously, there's a lot more to go into scene by scene or theme by theme, but that is kind of the gist of it. You have this anonymous vigilante that wants to overthrow an oppressive system, and this unknowing accomplice in Evie joins him. So it's a little bit different than the graphic novel. He's not quite the freedom fighter in the graphic novel as he is here in the movie, but I do like some of the elements that they sprinkled in the movie that weren't part of the graphic novel as well. So it's a very interesting take.
Oh yeah. So why don't we talk about some of the characters first, and we'll start talking about some of those plot points. First off, titular character, V, played by Hugo Weaving, which is amazing because he never takes off that mask. So we never got to see the actor.
Yeah.
But how did he do? How good of a job did he do?
On a scale of character representation, wearing a mask and never seeing their face, I think you've got Dredd. Who's the actor in Dredd?
Carl Urban.
Carl Urban. You never see his face. And then, you know, you've got obviously Darth Vader. Let's see. Yeah, he's somewhere in between those two. He does a great job.
Yeah.
He's able to emote without ever showing his face. And he does that through voice tone and body language. But he's great. And, he has that voice where you go, that's Agent Smith. But he does, he's, you get over that pretty quickly because V is different than Agent Smith. So yeah, it's great.
Speaking of the emoting, I was actually reading about how the people in charge of the lighting actually would change the lighting tone based on how he was emoting. In the actual book, one of the differences in the book, he actually has different drawings of the mask to show that emotion, but they don't do that in the movie on purpose.
No, I think they considered it.
They did.
I think they considered it at first, and then they were like, no, that would look ridiculous.
Yeah, he's like swapping masks out.
Yeah.
I'm glad they didn't do that. I think I like the way they did it. There was a lot of like head tilts and, you know, really, really fine movements that showed off that emotion. I thought he did a great job. I mean, I knew it was Hugo Weaving, but you didn't feel like it was watching Hugo Weaving playing character. You felt like you were watching V.
Right.
The female character you talked about that sort of helps him along the way, Evie. Yeah. Natalie Portman.
Yeah.
So relatable. She's such a relatable character from a female point of view. It's like getting swept up into this, you know, just the anarchy and like not knowing what to do and then being just thrown into it. The twist with her is so good.
I said earlier or later on in my notes, but I think it's a good thing to say here is that she's equal parts sympathetic and heroic. You kind of feel for her situation. And you get kind of mad at him a couple times the way he treats her.
100%.
But then you realize that in a way she is a hero now where she wasn't before because she was afraid to act.
It's the fear. And he set her free from the fear. And it's how he did it that was so controversial, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I was asking you guys that too. Like, how do you feel about her character arc? Because she goes from sort of I don't want to say mousy, but sort of a quieter person to where now she is blowing up Parliament.
Yeah.
Yeah. Where she's just like, this is it. This is what we're doing now.
In a year, in a 365 day, a literal year, she transforms.
I think they do a good job of explaining that though.
The pacing is a little different in the graphic novel, and it takes time for her to go from feeling like a kidnapping victim to an accomplice, to a terrorist. And so, like, I think that it moves, the pacing of this film is so fast that there isn't a lot of time to sit and like marinate on the character arcs. It's just like, bam, 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 now she's a terrorist.
Well, it's not just her. It's also the police detective that's kind of like working with them. There's a lot of, you can see what they're aiming for, but it is so fast. They have to say things like reminding you of how close they are to November 5th so that you can understand how much time has gone by. It's really hard to really display that time when you're only kind of seeing small little sections. You're not getting an overarching view. So it's not just her, although I think that is a good point, that it's really fast. Her transition isn't as fast as the character's name, but the police officer.
Right.
But it's there. But I think they spend more time on her so that her arc makes some sense, right? She does get rescued, and then she's unwillingly taken to his house, and then in the whole kind of capture segments, which I really liked that part, but it was definitely one of those, like, it also shows that V is still not making a lot of sense, too. He's not there.
He's not right. He ain't right in there.
No, no.
Yeah, he has a very, very interesting sort of sense of, I'm going to say right and wrong, but just sort of where his morals line up, because you're right, there's something wrong in his head. He's going towards a right-ish path. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah. He's an ends justifies the means kind of.
Yes, because the methods that he used to kind of free Evie from her fear are questionable, to say the least. But it worked.
Yeah.
It worked.
Well, Mike, you talked a little bit about it, too, that the difference between the comic and the actual movie. In the comic, V is more of a true anarchist than he is to a freedom fighter. Like in the movie, he wants to liberate, you know, England from this tyranny. In the book, he just wants to tear down all sense of government.
Right. Right. Yeah. The book feels more anarchist versus fascist, where the movie feels more neoliberal versus neoconservative, kind of not necessarily just like causing chaos for chaos sake. Like he's got like a code or a sense of justice. But in the book, he's really just kind of like a sociopathic anarchist that wants to like tear the system down. I think he would do that if he was in any system in any country. It doesn't have to be, you know, he didn't have to be in post-Thatcher UK for those kind of ideas to come out. He would have done that if he was in South America or Australia, you know?
Yeah, because this story is more of, in the movie, more of a revenge story.
Yes.
Versus tear down the government story. though he is tearing down the government, it's the same end, if you, it makes sense.
He's idealistic in both, but I think it's rooted in where that's rooted is in the book. It's anarchy, chaos. In the movie, it's justice, revenge.
Okay. Yeah, I was going to say, is it more personalized? Because he's going after the people that created him.
Now, the police officer, Finch, Jeremy, I think that's his name, is his turn believable?
It is, but less so. Again, I think his kind of suffers because they don't put as much time. He's in the movie. He's very integral to the plot, but there's not enough time to really focus on him kind of slowly seeing the truth of things, right? Or seeing that there is possibly more at stake than what he's aware of, right? That the overarching plot from 20 years ago or whatever that he's kind of unpeeled is there, and he's integral to you understanding what it is, but at the same time, you don't get to see his transition like you do for Evie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, if it was a limited series on HBO, there would have been an episode of him like talking about him. He has an alcohol problem. He's on his second divorce. You know, it would have really kind of made you feel more sympathetic for him as the way it is in the movie. Now it's more like you don't want to like him because he's one of the cogs in the machine. And then you realize that he's not quite happy with the way the machine feels, and he wants to look for the truth, and the people around him are managing the truth. And so that makes it very difficult for him. You start to realize that he's not one of the bad guys. He's just a good guy operating within a bad system.
Right.
Yeah.
I always like those characters that are kind of give you like the inside scoop of, you know, what the bad guys are really doing. And even to the point where they're like, you can't say that in this room. They're listening. You know what I mean? So even within the own team, it's like, who do you trust? Because he's finding out things, and it's like his partner, does he already know? All of that. So you're kind of seeing from the other side. And I think that's important to see, you know, when someone's trying to like figure it out and like almost like is a turn where they, you know, switch sides. It's like, what leads up to that and how do they get there? So.
Oh, yeah, because all authoritarian organizations like that is run by fear, right?
Yes.
Yeah. The second, his right hand, what's the name of the guy in charge of the whole thing? Was that
Creedy?
Creedy. And then his right hand wants to, you know, believes he's going to be taken down. He's the one actually, we'll get to the plot in a bit, but he's the one who actually does the deed.
Yeah.
Right. It's all about like controlling the information, who knows what, you know, and it's like only certain people get to know what's actually happening.
Yeah.
How'd you feel about the Dietrich character, Stephen Fry?
Yeah. So in the graphic novel, he's actually like a kind of a repulsive character. He's not somebody
really?
That you don't really root for him. He doesn't have a lot of the skeletons in the closet that are revealed in the movie. So you really don't have any compassion for him. But I think I read that Stephen Fry actually requested that they give him a more multidimensional aspect so that his character felt more like a real person instead of a caricature. And in the movie, I think he's very effective. I love Stephen Fry. I think he's great in anything that he puts his mind to. So yeah, I was really happy with his performance in this.
Yeah. In the books, if I remember correctly, it's been a little while since I read that, was that he was not a good person. He was, and he was just basically a member of the system. And when he gets taken down, you're like, okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think the character helped with also was Evie's kind of transition, right? She goes and stays with him. He seems to kind of be someone that's saving her sort of after she escapes. And then she watches him die from the government that she's now like, everything this guy's told me now is clicking into place. Like all these things are all fitting together. So I like the character. I liked it. Now towards the end of the movie, when they kind of show the crowd shots, someone they takes this guy Fox knife off and it's him. So at first I was like, oh wait, was he part of this scheme? That like he wasn't actually killed, was that just all to turn her? But then along with the rest of that kind of segment, but then there were other people that were part of the like story about the lesbians and whatever, they were all in there too. So I think it was just to show you that they're real. But
she's revealing to Finch that he was all of us, that
right.
He was you, he was me, he was my father, he was my, you know, my brother, like, and it's showing all these different people who have been a part of the story who have died for a revolution of sorts. So yeah,
if he wasn't the first one, I didn't realize the other was were. So when he did, it was the first one I noticed. I was like, oh my God, is he like faking it too? Like, was that how big this overarching, like, but then I realized other people were too. So I was like, okay, no, they're just trying to do that, but it was still cool.
Yeah. Like the little girl who got shot, who's doing all the graffiti. Yeah. She was in that crowd as well. So this is a good transition. Let's start talking about actual scenes. We kind of hinted at a lot of things, the things we liked. But where do you guys want to start? What scene do you want to sort of talk about first?
I mean, you know, her rescue scene when Evie is accosted in the, I think it's subway, but on the street corner, whatever, alleys. And that's when V kind of shows up out of nowhere and saves her, very Batman-like. And at that point, I knew enough about the story that I knew it wasn't like Batman. But I was like, okay, this does make more of a sense that this was a, you know, a graphic novel and has this kind of still superhero piece to it. Then I realized that's just a small piece of it. But that's the first like glimpse you get of him doing something. You're like, okay, he's got these fighting skills. He's clearly got, you know, a lot more than just, you know, he doesn't just build bombs, right? He's got a lot more going on than that. So I did like that as an introduction to the character. And then kind of then the juxtaposition of them, him in his own lair immediately after, like watching movies on people fencing and making breakfast and all these other like weird kind of just this back and forth. I really like that introduction to him, giving him a couple sides while still kind of very clearly being not your average person.
Yeah.
What is that whole, yeah, the whole part where she was like, who are you? And he goes, well, vicious, buffy, zavi, blah, 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 V. And then you're like, all right, he's insane.
Yes.
That was like your first glimpse into something is not right.
He's just a British rapper.
Have you guys heard Ren? Ren is a British rapper. When he's going through that whole monologue with all the V's, at a certain point you go, when do you run out of V words?
Yeah.
Because she was like, oh, thanks for saving me as a superhero. And then he did that. And she's like, okay, I'm going to go home now. Bye-bye.
You're knucking futs.
Yeah.
Yeah, time to go.
You can curse on here, too. But if you sort of, so don't worry about that. But you know he was practicing that. At some, like he's, you know, it's been 20 years since he was in that prison. You know, during that 20-year period, he said, okay, here's my monologue. I've got to practice this and get it on the first shot 20 years from now when I lay out my plan.
No stutters, no stumbles. Yeah.
You got to wonder how many times he's practiced that in his head. And like,
yeah,
that's what he does is he talks to himself, right, in his lair. So, I mean, like, that all becomes more apparent later.
On this watching, something occurred to me when I was watching it, too, that, you know, his goal is anarchy. His goal is chaos, right? But his planning skills are just top notch. I mean, it reminds me of, like, the Joker in movies, where the Joker is like, I want to just take down the system, but his planning skills are just amazing.
Yeah, disciplined for somebody who seems very chaotic and spontaneous.
Yeah, it's this weird sort of role. You see this in a lot of villains, too. Not that he's a villain. He's our hero. Where, sort of.
It's like, really?
Well, the term is what? Anti-hero?
Anti-hero.
Yeah.
But where they're super chaotic, like they want chaos, but to get to their chaos, they are the most orderly, tactical person that you have ever seen on film.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's playing chess when everybody else is playing checkers. Just put that.
They don't even know what game's going on.
Right, right.
He has planned out the entire thing. He already knows what they're going to do.
That's the thing. He's also by himself. He doesn't have a crew.
No.
Like you think at one point that he does, but it's not. It's him always.
So to take that to a whole new level, there's that scene where we're jumping around a little bit where there's dominoes. Mm-hmm. He knocks all those dominoes down. I was reading, it took a crew of people 200 hours to set it up. So one man doing this job, he's been doing this for months.
It's a cool visual element, but god damn, that was unnecessary. Seriously, what do you do with your time? You spent 10 years digging out the subway, you know, like how long did it take you to set up these dominoes? And what happened if you tipped one of them? Yeah. Oh my gosh. It was a great visual element, but you know, it's kind of like the crow putting, you know, lighter fluid or gasoline around
the crow.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, come on.
Visual storytelling. All the dominoes are starting to fall.
Except the one domino, which is
one domino, you knock it over and then all the people are now fighting back. That's it. It just takes one.
It's a much nicer, fancier version of the Punisher lighting that whole parking lot on fire for the Flaming Skull. But same idea.
Exactly.
He's like, go big or go home. That's it. Light it all.
One of the crazier scenes or sort of series of scenes, I think, is really when Evie is captured in Stephen Fry's home by a bag man. And then she's being tortured for months, weeks. I don't know how long it is.
It felt like at least 2 weeks. But yeah, it could have been longer.
How do you guys feel about that term? We sort of hinted at it in our earlier talks, but how do you guys feel about that whole process and then what the twist was at the end?
oh, this is my favorite part of this movie. It really is. Because it's one of those things that makes you have to watch the movie twice.
Yeah.
You know, to realize that, yes, there was people raiding that house that she was hiding in, but V was there and he's the one that took her. And that her perception of this fear and this torture, that's where she was stuck in her own mind, because the door was open the whole time. He shaved her head. They shaved Natalie Portman's head during filming.
God bless them that they did too. She has a beautiful shaved head. Like that woman is like beautiful. Seriously, you can't take your eyes off of her even after her head is shaved. And you're like, is that fair?
Yes.
Is that fair?
It's not fair. I know that she
as a bald gorgeous. Man, I'm like, come on.
Well, and there's an interview with Natalie, and she said she actually enjoyed getting her head shaved. She's been wanting to do it for years. So this just gave her the chance to do it and have an excuse.
Yeah, worth her excuse to do it. But anyway, but her experiencing kind of firsthand what some of these other people have gone through that were kidnapped and disappeared for being different, for being homosexual, for, you know, speaking up, that they were just kept in a jail and they were passing notes on toilet paper to each other. She had to experience that for herself, thinking it was real in order to be set free of that fear, right? So that to me was so powerful of that. It's like your fear is what's holding you back. And once she realized the door was open and the guards were fake and she walked out, that moment where she realized she was in V's hideout the whole time and that he did it to her. So I love her acting because you can see the range of emotions that she goes through where she's like, first of all, she's so thankful that it's not real. That she's not going to die, because that's where it was. Like, if you don't tell us,
we're going to
execute you tomorrow, right? That's where she was, or she was making peace with her own death. And then she walks out and it's V and she's like, you
son of a,
you shaved my head. You kept, and he was like, door was unlocked the whole time. And so all these emotions.
Yeah, I thought TikTok prankers were mean. That was awful.
I love that she yells at him for shaving her head before she yells at him for torturing her.
Right. That's a woman thing. You wouldn't understand. But then when she goes to the roof and stands in the rain and just like is renewed, she's.
I really like the imagery that they cut between him as young person escaping through the fire at the facility he was at and her having her moment of, you know, change and catharsis and, you know, being reborn. He was reborn through fire. She's cleansed through rain. Like there's this like very cool balance. Yeah. It was really cool to see it back and forth like that.
So yeah, such a powerful scene. It's what makes the movie worth watching 100%. I mean, the rest of it's really good. Don't get me wrong, but that scene, that plot, that whoever wrote that, chef's kiss, you got to go back and watch the movie again now because of that, you know?
So that was my question. I didn't watch it a second time. Are there clues throughout that you can tell that it's not real?
Well, you can tell it's Hugo in the shadows.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'll need to watch it again for that. I mean, I was still surprised when it was over, but I didn't go back and watch it again a second time.
When you listen to him talk, like when he's talking to her, you can tell it's V putting on an act because that's what he does.
I'll say the only goof that I think I saw was when he's shaving her head, he's wearing translucent gloves and you could tell that it's not his burnt hands. So as a filmmaker, I'm like, you should have put some latex blue gloves or, you know, something that you couldn't see through because I was watching already having known that was him. I was watching it and I was like, those are just normal unscarred hands.
Yeah.
And we've seen his hands. They're gnarly. Yeah. His hands are gnarly. So for them not to be all scarred up, I was like, come on guys, you could have done better than that.
Yeah. But simple solution, put on opaque gloves and that would have fixed it.
Right.
And you can tell too, when he's interrogating her, it's Hugo Weaving doing the creedy voice.
Yes. Yes.
It's off just enough.
Yeah, there's almost a little Agent Smith in there. You can hear it just slightly a couple times.
So let's go to a lighter tone. Mm-hmm. How do you guys feel about the Benny Hill sketch?
It's pretty funny. The music made it.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh, yeah, that was great. I love any time that a heavy story can kind of have a moment of like brevity like that. But even then, even with that brevity, you're like, oh, they're going to kill him for this.
Oh, yeah. Didn't think it was going to go on the way it did. I thought they would have made more of a public spectacle of it. But either way, yes, you did kind of assume. Because that's I didn't get anything from the character. Like you said, in the graphic novel, he kind of comes across as I don't want to say a bad person, but not a good person, right? Where I think that was the only part that kind of gave a flash of it, where he was kind of like, I don't give a shit. The ratings are going to be great. I don't care how mad he's going to get. What I have to do, apologize, who cares? Without that previous building of him kind of being that way, I thought that was a little, I don't want to say, but it didn't seem to fit with what you already saw of him, where he seemed like he was obviously very careful about these other collectibles he had. They're in a hidden room in his house. He knows, like, you can't push this regime too far. And then he goes out and pushes the regime as far as he knows how to in public and make
it was a little jarring if they had shown a piece of an episode where, like, somebody from the authority was like, hey, you got to cut that out. We're not going to let you get away with that. This is your final warning. Like, if they had something in there to kind of set that up to where you go, oh, he likes to buck the system. He wants to play their game, but he also wants to change the rules if he can. But there wasn't really any foreshadowing of that. So it did feel a little jarring.
Yeah.
It's a little more believable that the voice for the organization, I forgot what his name was, that guy, that newscaster, like he would be that way. Cause he was very much full of ego. He was like, nothing can stop me. And he's in a shower surrounded by televisions of himself showing his most recent broadcasting. And that's his level of ego. For Stephen Fry's character, yeah, you're right. If we had seen a scene maybe where he act like that at the studio, but instead you're kind of, at first you're like, why is Natalie Portman going to his house? No, for an evening, maybe that's the creepiness level we're getting. But no, he's using it as a cover. He doesn't care if she shows up or not. He wants people to think he's that way. But in the book, no, he is that way.
Yeah. I would say you don't stand in the shower and re-listen to your podcast and like say it over and over again while you're listening to it. Like you don't have that level of ego.
That's called the editing process.
Do all your editing in the shower. That's the right way to do it.
Always. My skin is well hydrated.
I was going to say about Stephen Fry's character, it's just like in the movie, without that context of him bucking the system, it's almost like, why is he doing that? Because he knows.
It's unmotivated.
He knows better. And he knows, like, if he's hiding things and he's putting on this front where he's having women over when it's not his thing, like, again, why are you pushing that far? Because did he want to get caught? Was he tired of hiding? Was he just like, F it, you know, fuck the system, I'm going out in a blaze of glory?
It does feel unearned and just kind of jarring in that way. Like, I feel like that character was, even though he worked really hard to make it a multi-dimensional character, there were elements of that character that could have been fleshed out a little bit more.
Yeah. Because from looking as a writer, it's kind of like, all right, well, this is done for plot-wise because we needed them to raid the house with Evie in it.
Yeah, in the four hour edit. Like in the like the long edit cut, there's more about him, I'm sure.
In the Snyder cut, yeah.
Yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about the false flag event that allowed this authoritarian government to come in, which basically they created a plague that attacks London. Mm-hmm. Did you guys feel that was a believable cause to allow this authoritarian government to take over London?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. If you would have asked me this prior to 2020, yeah, I would have been like, that's unbelievable. But now I'm like, could happen.
Yeah, 100%. In fact, we don't even have to actually do it now. You just make a Gemini video that it happened and everyone believes it and you're good to go. So you don't even have to actually create a plague anymore. You can just say there was a plague.
And I mean, in this day and age with the invention of AI, people have trouble discerning what is real.
Yeah.
Right? So that's why I'm saying, like, the stuff from the 80s where they're like, well, this could never happen. Let's write it down. This would be terrible.
Yeah.
Here we are, and we're like, could it happen? It could.
Yeah.
What were some other powerful scenes to you guys?
When the girl got shot?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yep. Because here they are. The police are trying to figure out the tagging. And when you find out it's this little girl in the Guy Fawkes mask, and it's like, that was another match that was lit to blow the powder keg. When they were like, you shot, you know, this 12-year-old girl.
Yeah, there are moments when the public will look the other way. And then there are moments when the public says, no, we can't have this anymore. And
she was killed
by a fingerman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, it's kind of funny. They have a whole system of their thing. Is you have the head, the eye, the ear, or sorry, they have the mouth. And I get the analogy, but when you get the fingerman, like, it, I was like, could we have had a different word?
Nah, it's like, they're aware they did it on purpose. They're dirty.
law enforcement in general is referred to as the hand, and then the agents are the fingermen. But they don't really go into detail. They don't really go into detail about the different like body metaphors for the different agencies. They don't do that very much in the movie, where it's pretty repeated over and over again in the graphic novel. So I was interested in that, that I didn't catch any of that this time.
Yeah, because you had the head is gonna, it was of course Adam Sutler. Mm-hmm. You had the mouth was the guy that was in the shower. And then you had the eyes were the internal surveillance, where they're saying based upon chatter, 82% of people believe he's alive. You know, that's the eyes. And you had, or that the ears, I meant the ears.
Eyes and ears, it's surveillance and audio surveillance.
Yeah.
And then you have the hand, which is the police, and fingers were the secret police. So I don't know why fingers are secret police.
They should have been the fist.
Just they just wanted to sound like dirty. They're
right. That's what it, nobody, that's what it was.
Nobody likes them. Man, yeah.
Nobody likes secret fingers. Got it.
No. Nobody likes the fingermen.
Nope.
I did like the audio surveillance. It's just a truck that drives down the street that listens to what everyone's saying on private phone calls or whatever, as opposed to just what now it's just internet stuff, right? So you're just like, yeah, no, we scrape this, or we, you know, have all this technology to figure out what people are saying on social media, everything else. No, and then they're like, well, that didn't exist. They didn't think about it then, because why would you think everyone's going to put all their personal information on a phone and say whatever they feel like with their tied to their name? So instead it's like, oh yeah, we'll listen to everyone's private phone calls with this machine that drives down the street.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy.
Ooh, people, what are we doing?
This movie clocks in just over 2 hours. Did it feel like 2 hours?
I don't think it feels like 2 hours. I've sat through some much longer feeling 2 hour movies. I feel like the pacing is so breakneck that if you start to get a little bit fatigued, you're already on to another what the fuck moment. So it feels like it moves pretty quickly for 2 hours.
I felt at the end, I was ready for it to end.
Mm-hmm.
It had been such an emotional roller coaster that I was like, God, I can't take much more of this. Like, it's got to end. Are they blowing this thing up or not? You know? So finally, when everything went down, spoilers, when V dies, and Evie launches the train, I was like, thank God. Like, I'm just ready for it to go.
Yeah. You know? I wanted to ask you guys what your impression of V's last stand against the Fingermen. How did you feel about that scene, the way that it played out?
Well, I'd say, first off, it's the most stylish fight scene we have in the movie. It's very slow-mo. We're following the blades. It looks like it's lifted directly out of the comic book.
It feels like a scene from like The Matrix or 300, you know, where it has that like stylistic blood, slow-mo ramping, you know, type of movement, like that kind of stuff. And it feels out of place from the rest of the movie.
Very much.
Me. Yeah.
The only thing that's close is, again, that first scene where he saves her in the alleyway. That's the only time you even see anything close to that from his, like, they kind of do a flashback even during that with him watching the fencing or working on the fencing against the doll in his house. But even then it was like, that's not the level of expertise you're using here in that moment.
I don't think he kills those guys. It's implied that he's just like beating the shit out of them. But there's no blood spurt all in.
Oh,
in
on the beginning, guys. Right. Yes. Yeah. That's why I was thinking it was very much Batman-y, where it was like, yeah, he has these skills to not kill you, but you're incapacitated for the moment.
That movie, Mike, for that scene, Mike, it feels to me that it was like a producer came back to them and said, we want bullet time.
Yes. You're the Wachowskis. You wrote this. Come on.
Yeah, you know bullet time. You'll make it work.
I feel like they had to shoot him, mm-hmm. or he wasn't going to go down. It's like he was so technically savvy as a martial artist that they were like, he can't even get close to us. We have to shoot him. And so that was the only way, again, for plot, where they were like, we have to kill him because Evie needs to take up the mantle, right? And the only way we can do it is to have like 15 guys shoot him. And then before he dies, he kills all of them. So, and I was just like, well, okay, it's a little excessive. There could have been some other way to get there, but oh well.
But so for 2 hours, guys, you feel like that, like I said, it sounds like you guys are all about it's the right length. Any longer, it will, yeah. may drag on too much, but there was no slow points.
It wasn't slow. I don't think it was too short, don't get me wrong, but if it was a little longer to some of those things we kind of missed out on, some of these arcs we didn't get to fully flesh out, I probably wouldn't have minded, because those things were kind of a missing moment where you're kind of, You know, even after the fact, it was thinking about, like, why did that exactly happen that way? If you could have had a few minutes in there to flesh those things out. But that said, I didn't need any more. Like, I'm glad they didn't go after the ending and continue with, like, and here's what happened to these people. And here's what happens. Like, I didn't want any of that. I didn't want to know what the future holds. I just want to know that this is what they resolved.
I think Michael put it the right way. By the time you're coming down off of the high of one scene, they already dumped you into the next one. And for me, like, I saw this in the theater as well. And it was just like, emotional roller coaster. If I could have watched this on streaming the first time, I probably would have paused it with Evie on the roof and taken a walk and come back, right? Because it was just so intense. So, like I said, at the end of it, I was just like, you got to let me off this roller coaster. I don't have any serotonin left.
Soundtrack. How was it?
I feel like it was not as important to the movie as other soundtracks. The only things that were important were the explosion, exploding the buildings, like blowing up the buildings, having the classical music going off during those scenes was very important. But throughout the rest of the movie, I don't feel like the soundtrack was that iconic or evocative. It didn't really, like, there were moments when I was like, is there a soundtrack? It just didn't feel like it was that important to me. I'm very musically focused. Our film that we're working on is part dystopian science fiction and all music. Like, it's not a musical, but it's like music inspired. And I felt like the music could have been a bigger part of it. I do understand why they went with the composer that they went with. He's, you know, kind of famous for classical ballet and theater. And if V was, you know, hiring a composer to do the movie soundtrack, he would have hired somebody like that. So I get it. I just feel like in somebody else's hands, it would have been a more powerful aspect to the film. It would have ramped it up just even a little bit more.
I wonder if they ran out of money. Just because, you know what I mean? Like, you can only have so much money to go around, and the visuals on this, and then you had big name actor.
Well, it was about a $50 million budget.
Yeah.
For the time. That's huge. It's probably closer. That would probably be closer to $75 or $80 million today. So that's a big budget for a movie that people didn't expect to be a blockbuster.
Yeah. And I mean, at some point, you know, some executive was like, I think your budget is just fine. We don't need to hire John Williams. Thank you. You already got Hugo Weaving on board. Be happy with what you got.
I was also glad they didn't try to add a whole bunch of current music to make it like edgy or whatever. That wasn't there. A lot of movies that go that route instead, where they're like, oh, during the intro, we're going to play this, you know, new metal instead. And you're like, well, that doesn't need to be in this movie.
A lot of needle drops and things like that. They did have, what was the one song? I'm looking for it now. They did have a song by the Velvet Underground that Cat Power did. It's on the jukebox. I Found a Reason. So that was a pretty interesting pull for them. And I think that they did one, maybe there was another track. I can't remember which one it was. I can't find it now.
Nobody cares. Nobody remembers.
Yeah, it wasn't as important. The needle drops, it's not like watching Pulp Fiction where the needle drops are part of the movie.
For me, I always like a soundtrack to either A, like you sort of said, be part of the movie where it's really important. Like, think Daft Punk with Tron Legacy, right? Where, like, that is the movie. Exactly.
Yeah.
And then, or it's so subtle that, like with this movie, you don't notice it. It's not that important. And because where you get the sort of middle ground where, like, a Daredevil, like, you know, Evanescence is playing, you're like, this feels wrong.
Yeah. 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 No, I agree. I agree.
So one of the biggest themes from the book was, we mentioned before, it's anarchy taking down the institution, taking down government. Does that theme carry through on this? And we kind of hinted a little bit, but what are your thoughts around that theme for the movie?
I think, as we kind of mentioned, that revenge seems more of the driving factor here. I mean, there's the anarchy part of it, there's the chaos part of it, but there's still, it's very focused. It's against people who have wronged him, with all the people that were at that hospital. And then that ties into this now, you know, government that has taken over was all behind this plot. So it seems like it's got more focus than a straight chaos anarchy overtaking the system.
It's like a large scale vigilante justice movie, you know, like instead of just going after one or two people for revenge, he's going after a system that has allowed this to happen, but it's still vigilante justice.
There's almost like a detective part of it too, you know, like a detective story where it's like trying to figure out why V is doing this.
Mm-hmm,
you know what I mean? And to find out that they are all interconnected, you know, and they all run the government. They're this, you know, deep state at this point. And but again, it's like you still have this personal revenge story that's built into it. So,
yeah, I feel like I could watch a whole episode of a series based on the detective work and the noir aspect of just some gritty, you know, on the street detective work, trying to uncover a conspiracy that nobody's really helping him, you know, get information from. So I think that that aspect works really well for me.
Now, do you guys think this movie can be made today?
Can it be made? Yes. Should it be made? Probably not. Two on the nose.
I think so. It'd be kind of like making a COVID movie now. I don't think anybody wants it. It's too, we've been too saturated and too, you know, we're at the point where we want to escape reality, not live in reality. And watching a movie about a fascist takeover of your government feels too real to what some people are experiencing. Not to make it too political, but some people feel that way. And so are they, if you're a producer with a big studio, your focus is like the four quadrant appeal, and you're eliminating half of your audience if you try to make that a political story that way. So I think that they could make it. They would eliminate a lot of the fascist elements and make it more, they might even make the fascist elements into a heroic aspect that they're trying to secure the people, make them safe and give them stability and not really focus on the evil of that, you know?
Yeah, it'd be far more focused on, I guess, on the chaos piece, right? On the chaos and anarchy piece.
I think you touched
on, which I think is less interesting if you're going to do that, but
I was obviously doing some research today, and it was talking about how, you know, Guy Fawkes is a real person, and that basically they're trying to twist that this person that was deemed a terrorist in a different time could be seen as a hero. So I think that they are doing this story.
Mm-hmm.
But with different, you know, like I've, a friend of mine writes this comic book called Ed Gein, Demon Hunter.
Yeah.
And it's like taking a story from someone that is just terrible and then twisting it to be like, but really there was a reason why they were doing this. So I think that's the meat and potatoes of this story is like, was this person a terrorist or were they a hero? And it depends on your point of view and how much do you know?
It also depends on who's writing the story. If you're writing a perspective, if you're writing Star Wars from the perspective of the Empire. the rebels are,
they suck.
They're terrorists. They're a small disorganized terrorist cell.
Lori, I can see that as being a poster. The rebels, they suck.
Yeah.
The
rebels you know.
Suck, period.
So, I think that depending on whose perspective you're writing it from, you know, the winners never think of themselves as the bad guys.
Right.
You know?
Right. The winners write history. So
yeah.
There you go.
So it sounds like we all like this movie, at least at some level, but there's always something that could have been done better. And what could they have changed or done differently that you think would have put this movie really over the top for you?
Man, that's tough.
I think it's the ending. Again, when they just firing squad shot V.
Yeah.
I didn't buy it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I think that there could have been a better finesse, a better ending for him.
It was a little rushed.
Bullet time. Yeah. It just didn't feel like it was the ending he deserved. So, I felt like that his death could have been done a little more heroically, gone down in a different way, but still ultimately, you know, inspiring Evie to step into his shoes. But don't ask me how. I just know I wasn't. That was like the one part of the movie where I was like, oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah. Come on. I like a story where the leader hands off the movement to another, an apprentice who's stepping up. And I would love a story of where does this go with Evie after all of this takes place? Does she just walk away from it? Or does she become a leader of a resistance movement in some way? You know, I kind of like that concept. But as far as you know, what they could have done to improve this, you know, it's all nitpicky. The things that I would like them to change are things that weren't necessary. It was just as effective with how they did it as opposed to, you know, the things that I would want them to add in. So it's an effective movie. It tells a good story and it's edge of your seat pretty much from beginning to end.
Yeah. If there was anything I already mentioned, Detective Finch and kind of his slow turning onto, and it's not like he fully ever like, he doesn't become a full rebel in this case, but he does at least see their perspective. He at least kind of understands why this government is at its core, probably rotten. And maybe this is the right thing to do, even though it wouldn't be how he would do it. And he's not going to cause it, but he might not stop it. I do think there could be.
He didn't cause it, but he didn't do anything to stop it.
No, like, he walked away, hands
he's
off.
He's standing there while she's flipping the thing, and he just lets her do it. You know, so obviously he sees a rotten core, and he doesn't think that this is all a terrible idea to some at some point.
Well, because I think he has seen throughout the movie that the government's lying to everybody. They keep twisting things. They keep changing things. That the PR even guy.
Even within themselves.
Yeah. So it's, I think he's realizing that he may have, I think he went into it just to be a police officer. I don't think he went into it to be like the head of this point part of the government. So everything what he believes in, truth, justice, the London way, are all being twisted. And so I think that's really what his motivation is. But for me, I think really two things. Jeremy, I agree with you on that one. I think that they explored him more would have been good, but then the movie would have been longer, and that would probably would have made it harder to finish that the movie. Yeah, that fight scene at the end, I'm okay with the fight scene, Lori. Like, I'm okay with him having it. I just don't like the way they portrayed it, because it felt very much like it belonged in the Matrix. It didn't belong in this movie. Like, I'm okay with slow-mo, but like having the trailing, I mean, don't get me wrong, it looked cool, but it was not this movie. Like that's
my problem with it.
It felt like a Temu version of a Zack Snyder scene to me.
Yeah.
You know,
it just wasn't, there was something to it. It just didn't feel right.
Yeah.
I felt like they could have done something different there. Not only action wise, but plot wise, like it could have been different.
Maybe if they hadn't come at him with like a group of like 15 guys, if it was like a smaller group of guys that were like chasing him through the subway tunnels and he had to take them out one by one, you know, it would have felt a little bit more earned.
Yeah.
But it just felt like it was kind of a weird mix of like a martial arts movie where like each guy takes their turn attacking him, but it was all with gunfire. And then he's like, oh, you guys are reloading? Okay, I'm going to take you out now.
Well, I think they were taking their turn taking a knife to the face. But that being said, you're right. This man has been planning this for 20 years. I think his planning for that scene should have been more than just the armor from the suit of armor, the chest plate, that is. I think he probably, like, if he maybe like the floor drops out from him, he drops away, and now he's got to hunt them all down one at a time. Or
that's what I mean, where again, it's like he did all this planning and he was always ahead. Was that his plan to die there?
Well, I think his plan was to die before the end. I think he wanted no part of the, because he said, I'm giving this to you, Evie. I'm giving you everything. He's trying to put the power somewhere else.
I didn't like that either. I see that on your face, Jeremy. Like, that was a cop out.
I think ultimately, and again, without reading the original graphic novel, if he had that more chaos agent anarchist piece, then he was planning on going on dying, certainly, but in that train.
Was he dying already? Because if he was already dying and then he had no plans to escape anyway, that would make sense. But again, it's like, if I don't know that he's already on his way out and he had plans to pass it on, and that's why he took Evie in the first place, like, then it makes sense. But it's like, again, did that end up on the cutting room floor? I don't know.
When she comes back, he says, I didn't know if I would see you. So he had initially had to have had a plan A that didn't include her. And then he's executing plan B that does include her. So what was his plan A? Was it to take all those guys out and crawl to the subway and you know, and start it? I mean, it just felt like
get everybody on the train and push the button and you can all just go blow up together.
We're all
going
to die together.
I did like how earlier in the movie they said, how do you think the attack is going to be coming? And only the police officer thought it would be the train.
Yeah. Yeah.
Everyone else thought it was the bombing or what have you, or, you know, plane.
Yeah. There, you always have to have the one person who speaks truth and everybody else like, ah, you're so full of shit.
You're an idiot.
So does this movie deserve a reboot or even a sequel?
I would love a sequel in a graphic novel version, but not in a movie. I would love for Alan Moore to give somebody else the opportunity to do a graphic novel sequel. I know he's a maniac and it would never happen, but I would love that. I don't think it's necessary. And I think that somebody could probably at some point, maybe after Alan Moore kicks the bucket, do a expanded story. I don't think it's necessary to go that route with a actual movie. I just like to think what would happen after this? Where does this go from here? But
would it be called like the V-verse?
No.
The Vendettaverse. Come on.
No. I am so staunchly in camp no reboots. Like, leave yeah. me alone.
Yeah. No, not a reboot. I would never want a reboot of this. Yeah.
But that's what they're doing, of course, because the whole no physical media on the back end. So they're just rebooting things that they know have an audience yeah. already, you know, there.
It's preloaded.
Yeah. But I mean, like, in an artistic sense, there is nothing that could be done to this movie to really make it that much more impactful. Mm-hmm. Leave it alone.
Yeah. Yeah.
Enjoy what's there. Do something new.
Or don't. I guarantee there are people who are like, this movie sucks.
Well,
I guarantee it. But they're wrong. But, you know, I don't think that this is like a 4 or 5 star movie for everybody. This is my wife probably doesn't really get into this movie. It's a little bit too political for her. But she probably would watch it just because Natalie Portman's awesome in it. And you know, Hugo Weaving is awesome in it, and the performances are great. She would appreciate that. But as far as like the political element, I guarantee there are people who are like, this is too much for me. I'm not into this. This is, you know. So I don't think that there's a market for a reboot or a sequel, to be honest. But for me personally, I would love to see the story afterwards.
So you were bringing up, like, there's somebody out there that hated it. So I had to bring up IMDb and look at the reviews and look at the 1 stars. And I'm not going to read them. But I just, there's one that I thought was hilarious. Says, why do we have to lionize terrorists?
See?
There's got to be somebody that, especially when you have something that could be taken politically, as obviously as this now feels like it fits in, you know, there's people that flat out hate this movie.
But I imagine those people also don't like a lot of other like underdog movies where they overcome a oppressive system.
I mean, do they? I mean, like Snowpiercer and like they're out there. There's a ton of other oppressive regime movies out there that did great.
I feel like those are my movies, man. I love those movies.
I'm with you. I live there.
If people are already complaining that Star Wars is too political, you're like, you're clearly finding reasons to be upset. So you're definitely going to find the reasons to be upset here.
Lori, I'm with you on this. I don't think it needs to be redone just because I don't think there's anything you can do to make it better that's worth the time. I would love to see them re-release this in theaters. Like they've been doing a lot of movies these days just because it's an easy lift for them. But I'm curious the reaction of people seeing this movie in theaters again.
I don't think it's the time for that unless you want to see some things blow up.
Yeah, I think it would go very poorly.
We already have a whole anonymous that wears the Guy Fawkes mask.
A whole marketing right? campaign where you get an anarchist cookbook and a Guy Fawkes mask at the
right.
theater.
I mean, they're there already. If anybody, you all know about Anonymous.
But you get
they're
popcorn
there.
In them. So it's cool. You get popcorn in them. So it works out.
Wouldn't V be proud of that, Lori?
Oh, yeah. I think that there are projects that carry on this, you know, this theme of what V started. Like, I loved Mr. Robot, the series. I think that it's an incredible dystopian, you know, system story. And it uses some very similar elements of, but it's more focused on like technology based anarchism and taking the system down literally from within it through its computer systems. And so I think that there are other stories where this kind of concept pops up. And if that's something that people want to explore, there is a genre there for them to go after and not necessarily make it publicly accessible for terrorist training organizations.
I think what I'd like, I don't want a sequel to this necessarily. Like, I don't need to know what happened tomorrow, right? After this, what happened the day after this? But if there was like a graphic novel or a series or something that was like 50 years after this, here's what the world is like. That would be interesting to me, but I don't need, what do they do right after the explosion? What does Evie do? Like, I kind of don't want to know what they do, but 50 years down the road, what has happened to the society? What do they believe happened in this event? That would be interesting.
It would have to be interesting enough, though.
Guy Fawkes took place in the 1600s. So like they're remembering him in this movie. What are they remembering V and Evie like? In 50, 60, 70 years, are they folk heroes or are they regarded as, you know, terrorist leaders? Oh, that would be interesting to explore. But yeah, I do like that.
Before you go on to rate it, any final thoughts?
I did write something out that I wanted to mention. There are some exposition heavy scenes. There are some scenes where characters are telling you the story, but I think that it moves it along in a way that, first of all, the information is necessary. And I don't think that you want to hear it over the radio or on a television broadcast. You want to hear it from another character. It's usually in the detective looking for information. And that's, I think that that's okay. But even during those exposition heavy scenes, it feels like it still moves pretty quickly. So that's the one thing that I did want to mention is some people really hate exposition. I think exposition gets a bad rap. You need to tell a story somehow, and you don't always want to do it through a third person or an element that's not a character in dialogue.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of exposition, but I like when it's done naturally. The one way not to do it is the new Tron movie, which spends 5 minutes showing news broadcasting at the very beginning of it. So that is not how to do it.
I've not seen it yet, but yeah.
I actually enjoyed it. Decent album. But like I said, the first 5 minutes were throwing me off.
I love that Nine Inch Nails was doing the album. So I was on board from that the moment I heard that. But yeah, I liked the Daft Punk album more than the second movie. So I don't know how I'll feel about the Aries. But the other thing that
it's going to be the same.
It's going to be the same.
Music. Whoa. Movie. I haven't seen it, so I don't know, but
I'm there with you.
It's got Jared Leto. It's going to be amazing.
I don't know how that man finds work.
Yeah.
Actually, he is one who made this movie happen, by the way. This is his creation, just so you're aware. I saw it. It's actually a decent movie, which is not what we're here to talk about today, obviously. The soundtrack, I haven't spent enough time with yet, but I had some issues with the soundtrack, but that's neither here nor there. Yeah. And I'm a Nine Inch Nails fan, too.
Well, if it distracts from the movie, then I could understand. Yeah.
So, guys, how do we rate this movie? Thumbs up, thumbs down, left, right?
I give it 3 Guy Fox masks.
I was gonna say a good red, disgusting looking thumb up.
I'm gonna rate it 2 sticks of dynamite and some classical music. Excellent.
Nice.
And I give it 1 solid subway train with nobody on it. So, guys, thanks for spending some time with us to go over this movie. But Mike, thanks for being here with us this evening. Where can people find you, and where can they find more about this movie you're making?
Yeah, we are currently fundraising for our film Speakeasy. You can check us out on Instagram at Echo Eterna or at Speakeasy the Movie. Or if you want more information, you can go to our homepage. It's speakeasythemovie.com. I can also be found on Instagram and Substack as Mike Writes Movies. And so I would love to talk more about our project with you there.
Awesome. And Jeremy?
You can always find me here talking movies with you every 2 weeks, but also on the Retrovaniacs podcast every other week, where I talk about old video games instead.
And Lori, who is not Fergal.
I'm not Fergal. I'm Lori Calcaterra, and you can find me on all social media. Make sure you tune in every Tuesday for the Tuesday Morning Brew to hear me interview indie creators, writers, artists, filmmakers, actors. We had a ventriloquist once, and it was awesome. And I also moonlight as Killer Karen if you want something alternative interviews. Yes, the blonde wig comes out and the Karen personality goes on. Please check out Path of the Pale Rider. We are currently working on issue number 7. Should be due out next month. So we're kicking butt and taking names there. www.pathofthepalerider.com.
Awesome. And I've actually been on your show before, so it was a lot of fun. And for me, you can always find me on Off Panel Creations. We're always building some piece of nerdy furniture. Thank you, our listeners, for spending some time with us. And if you want to see a picture of us all in a Guy Fox mask, send me a note over at movie-smash.com, and we'll see you in a couple weeks. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show. This has been Movie Smash with Chris Roberts, Jeremy Parmentier, and Fergal Amayo, produced by me, Chris Roberts, executive produced by Off Panel Creations, LLC. Movie clips provided by the respective studios. You can rate and review the show at Apple Podcasts and Spotify. You might even find your review read on a future episode. Got a question for us? Visit us at movie-smash.com and send us a note. It too can be read on a future episode. If you haven't already, please subscribe to Movie Smash wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Nobody likes secret fingers. Got it.